Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
And Jesse Mott.
What's this new guy doing here?
I don't know, man. He just walked into the studio, and we're like, why not?
They'll put anybody on the radio.
Yeah, sure.
Jesse is a big Lynn Ramsey fan, so we're going to be talking about Lynn Ramsey's new film. So thank you for joining us, Jesse. Welcome
to
the show. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans like Jesse, and we are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new dark, some would say very dark drama, You Were Never Really Here. But that's in the back half of the show, and for the first half, we are going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including that Black Widow movie that's always supposed to be coming soon. People have been waiting for years to see Scarlett Johansson's Super Spy get her own movie, and Marvel has narrowed it down to just 65 directors, so that's good news. And then we'll talk about the new trailer for the new Robin Hood movie, which looks and talks exactly like you think a Robin Hood movie would when it's made in 2018. And we'll talk about whether or not it's going to be appealing. But first, we're going to go deeper into the Marvel Universe a bit. And, you know, you may have heard our show last week with me and Candace reviewing Avengers Infinity War. And so now we're kind of getting the think pieces about what they did and what they didn't do and what the highs and lows. And I think when this has been revisited before... we get these big movies about end of the world stuff and monsters and superheroes fighting gleep globs and what have you, and not a lot of time for the romance and for for things. And so, you know, this was a think piece on Slash Film, and I want to get the... I can't even read my notes, but it was basically about how there's no time for romance in the Marvel Universe. It was called Marvel's Superheroes Have a Romance Problem. So, Vince, what do you think? Do you think Marvel's superheroes have a romance problem?
Well, I'm probably the least educated person to ask this about. I'm just not going to have, you know, an educated opinion about this. These are not my kind of movies, but... what is wrong with having a little romance in these movies? I don't understand what the problem is.
I think the problem is that there really isn't none. And that have you seen Infinity War yet?
I have. Okay. Yeah, actually.
So you will get this, that there's kind of a key plot point based on a relationship, a romantic relationship between two characters that hasn't really sort of been developed.
Oh yeah.
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 And I think the idea is that if you know. Maybe it isn't. These aren't Vince's type of movies because there isn't any romance in them. Maybe Vince is a romantic type, and he wants to see, you know, people get swept off their feet. But you know, it does seem to me that, you know, you're thinking about all these movies. And there was another piece that was on a site called Rogues. I think it's called Rogues Patrol, but it was about how the Marvel Universe have a particularly a women problem that you have. You know, Pepper Potts, who is in Infinity War, the Gwyneth Paltrow character, who's after several movies still kind of underdeveloped and kind of only known for being Tony Stark's romantic interest.
Yeah, no, I think it is not just a Marvel problem. I think it's actually a comics problem too, because they tend to gear towards like teenage guys for the most part, but there are a fair amount of women that read comics, and I just...
Yes, there is.
I guess they just don't kind of latch on to that understanding. It's just like developing... I guess they need a bit more voices involved in the making of these movies.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's something very tinny about it, but, you know, I was pointing to you guys that there was this, somebody wrote on AV Club that this was actually not a problem in the Wonder Woman movie, where actually a romantic relationship is kind of built into it, and maybe that could have been because there was a woman at the helm of that movie, and it was a movie where the woman was the superhero. But I think that... And Vince, if you're not into the Marvel movies, you're probably not into the DC movies.
That's accurate.
But, you know, I think this is something that the DC movies have actually done better than the Marvel movies, is that you have people in romantic entanglements, where that is Wonder Woman. And I know a lot of people made a big deal about, in Batman v Superman, there's a scene with implied bathtub sex with Superman and Lois Lane. And that, you know, that had people kind of like... Superman and Lois Lane getting busy? I don't know about this. But, you know, why wouldn't they? They're in a romantic relationship.
Yeah, and that's that relationship has been since the dawn of that comic back in the 30s.
they've probably had sex at least once in 80 years.
Well, they've been married.
Yeah. The problem that I saw was that they're big spectacle movies and that they're like, right. Let's keep them big spectacle movies. Let's not add in all of the romantic subplots. You know what I mean?
Right, but they do add romantic subplots. They're just not terribly well developed.
Well, fine.
I could see if you don't want to focus on that.
Right.
But they add it, with a light brush and
actually there's one Marvel movie I can think of that does have a bit of a romantic story. It's Ant-Man.
Yeah.
Like they do hint at it, and who knows if they actually develop with that with the upcoming Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Yeah. I mean that's an interesting case because it was also a superhero where he has a family life. Yeah. He has a very tangible connection. He has a child, and that's kind of unexplored area with a lot of superhero movies. A lot of them are single people, unattached, or find this one person to attach to. Another one is I think people could probably point to is Deadpool.
Yes. That was one I enjoyed.
Yeah.
I saw Deadpool, says Vince. but, I think it was on the Slash Filmcast, a review, they were pointing out that the Marina Bakarin character in that movie is kind of very teenage male fantasy because, she's foul-mouthed and, is pretty much a sex object from the word go. But I mean, that's a romantic relationship. It's about him trying to get back to his lady in the end. So, I mean, that's, I guess, the exception that proves the rule.
Yeah, and actually with the first three Batman movies, the ones that Tim Burton and Joel Schumacher did, they had that romantic rapport. Mm-hmm. And I guess, at least to an extent, in Batman Begins and The Dark Knight.
Yes, that's true, too. I think, those movies were... It's not entirely organic. I think the Vicky Vale one in the first Batman, but it is. I find Batman Returns that romantic relationship with Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman interesting because that character is very, very interesting. But also the Nicole Kidman character in Batman Forever, where she's kind of like obsessed with Batman in like a almost fatal attraction way.
And actually, like tying it back to the comics too. Yeah. Batman and Catwoman are actually going to get married.
That's very true. That's true. That's happening this summer, I think.
Yeah, issue 50, I think.
But is the problem that she was just a damsel in distress and not actually a fully fleshed out character? Is that the issue?
Well, in the case of Infinity War, you have Scarlet Witch and Vision, who are two characters who are kind of just introduced because...
And they are romantic. They're romantically involved in the comics.
In the comics, yeah. Mm-hmm. They have kids in the comics, which, how an android and a mutant have kids is...
debatable, right.
It gets into some weird science.
Right, okay.
But, it has to do with that I think the characters have probably shared maybe 5 minutes on screen together, and then the climax comes down to... Basically, spoiler alert for Avengers Infinity War, but like he has an infinity gem in his forehead, which is this CG monster Thanos is trying to collect. Mm-hmm. So she has to kill him in order to destroy the Infinity Stone. And it's supposed to be this like big romantic sacrificing gesture, but how can you do that when they've shared 5 minutes of total screen time over a couple of movies?
Write a better script.
Jeez.
Have deleted scenes in the extras.
Well, I think we solved the Marvel Universe's problems right here.
Bam.
Write better.
Why haven't they hired me yet?
Yeah. Oh, good question. Well, maybe there might be room to hire Vince in the future on Black Widow because there are 65 other directors in contention. And this is something... Again, maybe Vince can, go get a drink of water during this conversation.
Okay, yeah.
But, I'm just kidding. But, you could... But it seems to me, Scarlett Johansson's been Black Widow since Iron Man 2. That's 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an incredibly popular character. And they haven't got around to making a movie based on her yet. And I would have think, honestly, and this is something I thought for a lot of years, she would be one of the easiest ones to do, not just in because... You have an actress who's already well established in a part, but she doesn't have superpowers. So you can do something maybe a little more lo-fi that you don't have to do like a huge like 200 million blockbuster for. And I was always thinking like, you know, you could do like a down and dirty kind of like Born Identity style movie with Black Widow where it's all practical effects and fight choreography and, you know, all, you know, travel logging across Europe to go to different things. And it would be fairly easy to do, but I don't know if Marvel realizes that or maybe if I'm oversimplifying it.
Why are they trying to farm so many directors? What is it that they're looking for? Is it somebody that's going to abide by their vision and make a lot of money or somebody who's going to actually respect this character? Because I remember Soderbergh was saying, and again, we come back to our good friend Soderbergh.
come back to your good friend Soderbergh.
He was doing, yeah. when he was doing Out of Sight in 1998, he was saying, you know, there was a list. They were doing the same thing. They were bringing in directors to do interviews to see who would be the best fit for that film.
Yeah.
And they ultimately went with him because they felt like his vision fit the material the best, not because he was going to play ball with them, so to speak.
I wouldn't be surprised in the case of Black Widow if it's actually somebody that Scarlett Johansson actually wants to work with. Like maybe that's what the problem is. Because she probably has like, I guess like certain actors will have it in their contract that they have to like sign off on a director.
Like veto powers, yeah.
Okay, but why are they going to, why are they interviewing the director of Mustang? Why are they interviewing the director of a United Kingdom? And then, you know, very, very kind of niche, kind of low budget films, and then giving them these massive properties to work with. It seems very counterintuitive. It's like, why would that person who made that kind of movie be interested in making this kind of movie?
Well, it's two things. One, that's how they've been doing it for a long time. When you think about like somebody like Colin Trevorrow or even Rian Johnson on Star Wars. You know,
sure, but he started out with, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like he kind of made a progression. Like Looper, you know what I mean, was a very kind of it was very much Rian Johnson's voice in that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it kind of looked like a big Hollywood movie almost.
Yeah, and again, if you go to Ryan Coogler too, it's like, you know, he started out with Fruitvale Station, you know what I mean? A kind of very small independent film. And then he went to Creed, which was kind of a bigger studio movie, but still had that kind of independent kind of drama to it, I guess. And then they gave him Black Panther. It's like, why would the director of Mustang be interested in doing Black Widow?
I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm saying that's kind of been the trend. Like somebody like Jordan Voight Roberts, who did The Kings of Summer and then went and did Kong Skull Island, or who else was I thinking of just now? That'll come back to me.
Well, Edgar Wright. I mean, that's why he walked away from Ant-Man, because I don't think he felt it would have been part of his vision. Like, I think he probably got uncomfortable with it because of the simple fact that you'd had to have all these tie-ins to other unrelated stories.
Right, it's not just the tie-ins, too, but you have to sort of make the film look of a type that it has to fit in with the overall aesthetic of the established universe. And some directors are able to work within that and put their own personal stamp on it, like Taika Waititi or Ryan Coogler, or even Rian Johnson in the case of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. But for others, and not the other thing though, is that I think they want a woman to direct it, which is why they're going with, 'cause, you know, there aren't a lot of female blockbuster, I think, female blockbuster filmmakers. So you've got Patty Jenkins now, and you have, I guess, good Lord, it's a bad day for names. Zero Dark Thirty, Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah.
I think those are your two.
who in her day, like when nobody else heard of her, I mean, she did, what was that, Keanu Reeves?
Point Break.
Yeah, Point Break.
Yeah.
Which is
and
fantastic.
Strange Days as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. It's, and here's where I'm going to get, you know, kind of maybe, you know, in my own thing. But it's like all of these people that are like stressing that it has to be a female driven director. It's like, how many of you saw, you know, how many of you supported The Beguiled? You know what I mean? How many of you gave your money to Sofia Coppola? How many of you went and saw Detroit? How many of you supported Catherine Bigelow? How many of you saw you know, Lady Bird. How many of you supported Greta Gerwig? So it's like, I don't know. Fine. They'll get a female director and it'll be a very admirable movie. That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the smaller kind of the female directors that are taking real risks and doing real daring and original work. And sure. I'm sorry that that's off topic, but who else is going to promote those kind of things? You know what I mean? It's like, fine, you're going to flock to Black Widow, but you know what I mean? What about those smaller ones? You know what I mean?
Well, I think there are a lot of it's a valid argument that there's not much room in the current economy for mid-budget and small-budget films. You have the huge movies like this for the most part, like all the Marvel movies, and you have like the small micro-budget stuff that's bought by Amazon and, you know, made for $1 million or $2 million. And
who also, yeah, like I didn't realize that You Were Never Really Here is an Amazon movie.
Although Amazon doesn't get as much trouble as Netflix, but that's another tale because they still believe in big screen releases. But the other problem too is Marvel I think is obsessed with getting the right female director for this, but this hasn't sort of been a priority of theirs because, you know, they're kind of getting around to their first female-led superhero movie next year with Captain Marvel. And even that's like a filmmaking team. It's a man and a woman filmmaking team, the Mississippi Grinder team. Was, again, names I can't.
That was a good movie.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, it was a very bizarre movie, but a good Ryan Reynolds movie, actually.
Right, but that's another one of those, you know, smaller movies, give them the blank check.
My problem is that they might lose their voice if they're given those big things.
Yeah.
And, you know, selling out, as far as I'm concerned, means you're doing a film that you don't want to do. But it's like, how many of them convince themselves that they want to do it because there's a lot of money involved? You know what I mean?
Well, but how much of it, too, is, you know, you make a big movie like that, and then you can write your own check.
Actually, just to back up what Vince is saying, I mean, look at Joss Whedon. He hasn't done anything since Age of Ultron. Like, I think that movie put a lot of pressure on him.
No, it did, and then he did, but he did, you know, I think the majority portion of whatever Justice League came out too, I mean, that's a point too. This is, you know, Joss Whedon, someone with a unique voice, a unique point of view, not necessarily universally beloved. I mean, in terms of the grander movie on, it definitely has his fans.
And he was actually initially involved with Wonder Woman. Like, he wrote an initial spec script for that movie.
Yes, he did. That's true, too. And then he was going to go and do Batgirl, and it seems like I haven't heard him. I think for a while after Ultron, he was talking about doing some supernatural movie set in World War II, but I haven't heard about that lately.
No, I haven't either.
And it seems like he's... And maybe Vince has... Maybe Vince is right. Taking us on this tangent. Maybe the more important thing is that, you know, not necessarily about fostering female voices by giving them the big keys to the big movies, but by, you know, supporting the Beguileds and the Detroits out there. And
Well, that's,
you win, Vince. We're not talking about superheroes anymore.
Yes. All right. You wanted me to go for a drink of water. No.
No, I meant for you to bring some back for the rest of us.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry about that. So that's all I'm... again, you know what? You can call me pretentious, but it's like, who else is going to promote those movies? You know what I mean? Who else is going to tell people to go see, you know what I mean, those... Mudbound. That was a movie that I was telling everybody to go watch, and you can go watch it right now.
Easy to find on Netflix. Yeah.
Absolutely. All, like, female... crew on that, including a wonderful female director, Ava DuVernay, as well. Like, her documentary is on Netflix as well. So
13.
It's like, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not concerned about how or who directs Black Widow. I want to keep the voices and the
talent
yes, of the other incredible female directors.
All right. If you want to call Vince pretentious, you can go to our Facebook page.
And absolutely. Yes.
Speaking of pretentious, new Robin Hood movie coming. And I do want to play a clip from the trailer because it is kind of interesting.
There's been whispers.
He's got our commoners looking up, seeing hope.
If I may, I propose a bounty. 1,000 a week until he's caught or killed.
I've never seen anything like you.
You stare death in the face.
That's why I chose you.
You're not curious? He's under the hood.
He's obviously well trained.
You flatter him. He's a smash and grabber, nothing more. Who do you think the thief is?
He's all of us.
You're an admirer.
He has his qualities. He's not you.
Are you sure?
And that's when we get a spoiler. That's how you spoil a movie, I think. Because Taron Egerton is very clearly Robin Hood. But in that the first half of that trailer, you're meant to think that he's not Robin Hood. So congratulations, Lionsgate, for, you know, shooting your movie in the head. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
I have more to say, but
because they never give away the whole movie in the trailer anymore.
But it's never, I mean, it's rarely that blatant, though, I think.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's like, this is clearly meant to be a thing where he's like undercover as, you know, one of the rich D-bags of Nottingham. And then it turns out he's like, is it a secret? Is it not a secret? Like, what are you doing, Lionsgate, is my question.
I don't know, and, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, they have, I think, a good opportunity to make some sort of commentary on, you know, the current kind of political state of, you know, rich and poor. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously not going to do that. They're just going to do, you know, the extravaganza. That's what I saw from that trailer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought I was looking at the trailer and I thought, wow, this is like almost as though Guy Ritchie or some of that quality was directing this. Like, it just seems
and
so over the top.
And didn't he do
the King Arthur movie. Legend yeah. of the Sword? And that's exactly what I thought of.
Yeah.
Even though I kind of liked King Arthur and the Legend of the Sword, it was, you know, it had energy yeah. to it. It was, you know, it was like every other King Arthur movie ever yeah. made, but
I also didn't see the Russell Crowe Robin Hood.
Right.
So what was that?
That's
ultra realistic. Is it?
It is.
Okay.
yeah.
Ridley Scott.
It's Ridley Scott, so it's well made. But they cut out what was the most interesting part of that, which I think of the script was basically that Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham were one and the same in that in the original version of that script, and it was like some sort of pantomime that the sheriff was putting on to, you know, to, I guess, to make work for himself. I don't know, but I can't remember the exact story, but that was the point of that. And so, yeah, that's an interesting angle
that
to say,
be.
You know, what if this guy was two sides of the same coin? But this is just, it looks like Arrow. By that, I mean the TV show Arrow.
Right.
But,
yeah, in a way, that actually looks bizarrely funny in the way that Robin Hood Men in Tights was bizarrely funny.
I don't think there'll be any reason. Dance numbers.
So who's directing this one? Has anybody heard of this person?
The name is Otto Bathurst.
Right.
I actually looked up his credits. He actually directed the first two or three episodes of Peaky Blinders, which is a great show.
He's done a lot of British TV.
Okay.
Vince is unconvinced. He did a Black Mirror too. So he's not inexperienced.
I'm a little more convinced now.
He also did some Hustle, which is a BBC show I liked a lot. But yeah, it's not like going to break the mold. And you have Jamie Foxx in here. When I first saw Jamie Foxx was in it, I thought, are they going to do something like bold, like make Jamie Foxx Robin Hood?
Yeah,
because that would make sense. Like, if you know, being a black guy in medieval England, you know, you'd probably feel a bit like an outsider anyway, and you might, you know, go about to, you know, upset the system, and that would have some very pointed sort of political
again what
allegory.
You're saying is they have an opportunity to say something potentially
yes.
interesting
yes
and I just don't think they're gonna do it.
No, I don't think they're gonna do it either, but
it's like it almost seems like the Ridley Scott Robin Hood is like akin to the Thomas Jane Punisher, and now this one is like Punisher Warzone. It's just straight action and you know, showmanship. It's just thrills, you know what I mean?
I can't wait for the scene where Doug Hutchinson as Sir Guy of Gisborne gets his applesauce back. That'll be I want my applesauce back.
I'm getting more convinced as we're going along. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who's written this screenplay? Does anybody know?
The movie's really coming along.
we need to copyright this conversation.
When I saw it, I thought I was just like, wow, this is Blaine over the top, like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah, but that's another great point. Is like, what's the difference between the Ridley Scott one and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? Other than you're, you know, changing the faces and the cast members.
With Kevin Costner.
One with Kevin Costner.
That's worth watch. I mean, it's campy as S, but you know, it's but it's worth watching because, you know, Alan Rickman is just eating the scenery.
Morgan Freeman's great in it too.
Morgan Freeman. He's really great as sort of a mentor.
Mary. I can't remember who plays Maid Marian in the movie.
Master Antonio.
Yeah.
Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio. Yeah, she's good. we're just talking about better Robin movies. But you know, this one has like we said, Jamie Foxx and Ben Mendelsohn as the sheriff. Ben Mendelsohn is a great bad guy, so maybe there's something there.
And Jamie Dornan, who is in all the 50 Shades of Grey movies, but he was also in The Fall.
Yeah,
I just didn't see what would traditionally be classified as the Robin Hood myth. It was like arrows flying at you from, you know, every angle, explosions, romance, everything. It's like, you know what I mean? Where is the actual steal from the rich and give to the poor? Where was that element?
You didn't see the part where he's like throwing the bags of money against the wall? And
I saw the the millisecond clip where, yeah, he gave it to whoever. But
and you heard Taron Egerton. He's a smash and grab man, nothing more.
Okay, yeah. Now you win this one. All right.
Excellent. As long as I win one. We're going to take a break and play a little music, and then we will get completely depressing talking about You Were Never Really Here. To play us into that, though, here's a little Unknown Mortal Orchestra, which is number one right now on the CFRU charts. This is from their latest album, Sex and Food. I don't make the titles. But this song is called Everyone Acts Crazy Nowadays, which seems apropos. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Did you hear that sound, baby? I'm gonna jump it down. Forward, spread this feeling. Forward, inspect this feeling.
You have kids, Joe?
No.
Nina. Her name is Nina. I've heard of these places. Underage girls.
Senator, if she's there,
I'll get her. Cleary said you were brutal. I can be.
And that was a clip from You Were Never Really Here, which is the new film from Lynn Ramsey. And it stars Joaquin Phoenix, Alex Manette, John Dorman, and Judith Roberts. Oh, this was tough to get through. But I think it's an impressive film. Lynn Ramsey, people might know from We Need to Talk About Kevin, another movie that is not easy to sit through.
Well, she also got some flack recently because she was supposed to direct Jane's Got a Gun. And
the first day
of principal photography, she did not show up. And so there was all of this backlash. Lynn Ramsey is, you know, irresponsible. She let everyone down, which was not really the case. Okay. She sensed that the producers did not have, were not sharing her vision on the film. Okay. They wanted coverage on all of this stuff. They wanted a happy ending. Mm. And she sensed that they were not on board with her, so she backed out of it.
Yeah,
and which I think is, you know, was very underreported. she was very criticized for it, but ultimately I think speaks volumes about the kind of filmmaker that she is, which is a no BS. I'm going to do the film that I want to do. Kind of filmmaker.
Well, maybe we can take solace in the fact that nobody's talking about Jane's Got a Gun.
That's true, yes. So who directed that? Gavin O'Connor, or who was that? I don't know.
Well, I can look it up.
It was she spent months in pre-production on that film, learned how to, you know, shoot horses at, you know, the correct frame rate and, you know, at a very stylistic kind of way. And
Gavin
then,
O'Connor.
Okay, so yeah. You know, from what I understood, it was a very okay movie. But again, who knows what it would have been if Lynn Ramsey had done it?
Yes, I can imagine it would have been quietly discomforting.
I
like
would agree.
This.
But she's such an incredible filmmaker. I think she. It's funny because she does a lot of like masculine films as well. Like We Need to Talk About Kevin was, you know, also about the same way that this film, You Were Never Really Here, was also about kind of a male, a very kind of violent male lead as well.
I was actually listening to an interview that she did a few days. She did it a few days ago, and she basically said is that she's aware of the fact that she focuses on male violence, but that is not necessarily her intention of the movie. Mm-hmm. Is to make a commentary on like masculine violence. Like she is like very self-aware of that.
Again, mm-hmm. She, as we were talking about before the show, she came from a very kind of maybe masculine is the wrong word, but a very tough neighborhood in Glasgow, Scotland as well. So maybe that, you know, being around those characters kind of influenced her as well. But with that being said, I was blown away by this movie. I mm-hmm. loved this movie, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I definitely appreciated about the movie was the cinematography. Every single frame in the movie looked like very picturesque. And mm-hmm. I could tell that it was like probably painstaking just to arrange every single shot. But there was – I also felt that she was like very – probably well aware in terms of like editing the movie because like – it's one of those movies that stands up incredibly well, like frame by frame. And mm-hmm. I can honestly think of like huge blockbusters that simply don't allow for that kind of scrutiny.
Yeah. I liked it a lot too. I think that it's sort of impeccably put together from the point of view of how shots are framed, the sound design. It's, you know, a lot of the scenes where you see Joaquin Phoenix sort of out and about on the street, you know, it's almost like it's voyeuristic. It's not really mm-hmm. capturing him. It's not about making him the star, making him the center of the frame. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, shot through fences and shot, you know, through subway trains. And he's almost like a shadow in this movie that is like all about him. I think he's in every scene. The movie is very much from his point of view, and I mean, and that adds to a certain respect, you know, what's going on with this character's inner life, where he's saving young women and girls from sex trafficking.
It's been compared to Taxi Driver, and I think it's well deserved as well.
I think it's a bit more. I think it's a bit more subtle than Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
I think I think part of Taxi Driver is still where we're talking about that masculine violence sort of thing. It's very much in that mold, but I think Taxi Driver just wants to shock you with its violence. And Lynn Ramsey makes a very specific point of not showing the violence.
Yeah.
You don't see the hammer strikes.
Yes.
You see, you know, you see him maybe raise his hammer, and then the scene where he infiltrates the sex house, I guess, if we're going to call it, the trafficking house, it's all shown through the security monitors.
Cameras,
and it all bounces through the various...
Oh, such a great sequence.
It's a great sequence, but it's also a great conceit that lets the camera move away.
Yeah.
And you see a shot of Joe, the Joaquin Phoenix character, raising his hammer about to strike a security guard, and then it cuts away and it cycles through two or three or four other shots, and then it comes back and you see a guy on the floor.
And I thought that sequence, yeah, one of the first sequences in the movie when they show the security camera footage, that was the one sequence that reminded me very much of Taxi Driver towards the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Except shown from a slightly different
Freudian
point
slip
of view.
There.
Yeah. But yeah, it reminded me of the end sequence in Taxi Driver, but it showed it from a different point of view, and like it made sure that it wasn't overly violent, whereas the ending of Taxi Driver was.
Right.
Like, she is so kind of anti-cliche, too. Like, you don't want those kind of slow-mo close-ups of, you know, a guy getting hit with the hammer and then doing the kind of dance as he falls down. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She's so opposed to all of those kind of conventions. You know what I mean?
Although there was a slow-motion sequence in the movie, like, when he was taking his mother and like her body in towards the lake. Mm. That was a slow motion sequence.
Which I heard, okay, they brought the cut to Cannes and shot that stuff like days prior to the screening at Cannes, the underwater sequences and all of that stuff, and then just edited it together. It was, it seemed like a very quick shoot. It was shot in 29 days, summer of 2016, in New York City. And they were only 5 months into editing it when they did screen in Cannes, which is, you know, it wasn't the version that we all saw, you know what I mean? It was something else.
Still got a 7-minute standing O.
Yes, absolutely.
But it's the violence aspect to it, though. Is that there's a version of this movie that is very much like in the mold of Taken, where it's about the man, the hero man, going about and punishing very bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating is, it does sort of invert that convention. And she's not interested in the, I guess maybe the violent wish fulfillment, you know, that we have people in society who who do sex trafficking, and young women and girls and even young boys fall prey to it. And we would love to be the guy with the hammer going around and knocking the stuffing out of these predators. But it's not about them. It's about Joe.
Yep.
It's about, you know, we never fully understand him. We see quick cuts of that are sort of like flashbacks of what's going on in his head in military service. I think he was in the FBI
some abuse,
at one point.
From his father.
Right.
It's kind of alluded to. It's almost like Midnight Cowboy, the way it doesn't kind of, it gives you these flashes and it lets you kind of fill in the blanks of what it or what it's trying to suggest. And it doesn't go into these deep character motivations. You know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, like that's the one thing that became very clear to me watching it, is the simple fact is they clearly have like someone who suffers from PTSD. Mm-hmm. And that's the same case with Travis Bickle and Taxi Driver. He suffers from PTSD. And even a movie that I recently watched, Indian Runner, the character that Viggo Mortensen plays, he's a character just returning home from Vietnam who suffers from PTSD. And it's all about how their reactions back into society and how they suffer from it. And sometimes it becomes clear as to like what's going on in this person's life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't. Like, this movie is like very, very unclear, and you don't know what it really is disturbing him. You only get like slight hints at it.
But yeah, it's also very kind of straightforward as well. It sets up everything in the beginning, and then the rest of the movie is kind of just dealing with the characters that it's already set up. It doesn't do any kind of, it doesn't throw any curveballs at you. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's almost like Drive with Ryan Gosling in a way. Where there's a big event, and then it kind of, the rest of the movie is kind of the fallout of that. You know what I mean? So he's, Joaquin Phoenix's character is kind of a hitman, I guess you might say. His weapon of choice is a hammer.
Yeah.
He lives with his mother. It's such a unique kind of character. And he put on a lot of weight for that role too.
His physicality is very interesting in it because he has long hair, he has a beard, he is big. You can sort of see that this used to be someone who is muscular, but maybe he's gone to seed a bit because he is also pudgy. But at the same time, though, he's scarred, so you know, you can tell he's been through some things, and there are a lot of shirtless scenes where he's walking around shirtless, and you can see the scars. And It's also how he carries himself too. He's very lumbering in scenes. You see him kind of just walking along, kind of just shuffling, and it's like he's kind of a, you get the sense he's not really present in his own life. He's just kind of.
Actually, it was funny too, like just seeing him with the beard throughout the movie. I don't know why, but I was just reminded of another movie that he did with a beard, and he was like wearing dark glasses and like ridiculous hair. He's like, I'm still here with Casey Affleck, and a movie that from what I understand caused him a lot of flack.
Yeah,
and he's and it was funny too, like listening to the interview that Lynn Ramsey gave, is that Joaquin Phoenix doesn't really like to do interviews because he doesn't really like to talk about the process of like acting. He just simply wants to be present in the making of the movie, and then like he doesn't want to talk about it afterwards. And you kind of seem like that he's a very conflicted guy, like, and he always tends to play very conflicted characters as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is funny that it was released in 2016, and now it's kind of being showed, but I think that was it. He was only available for that time because he was doing whatever it might have been.
He's a busy guy.
Right. So she was like, are you available for 8 weeks to shoot this? And he was.
To bring it back to Marvel movies, actually, I believe that he was actually initially the first choice of water. Doctor Strange.
Oh, really? He was actually. They wanted him for Doctor Strange, but stuff happened. But it's funny bringing back to Marvel movies, because I was thinking about this, because he's got a beard, long hair, he fights with a hammer. Sound like anyone we know. I don't know if that was an intentional, because this is based on a book, so I don't know if that was in the book that he's his weapon of choice is a hammer, but it is almost a commentary on this again, revisiting that, like watching good guys get bad guys. That, you know, here we have another guy with a hammer fighting bad guys. I don't know if I'm maybe reading into that. Vince is wincing so hard right now.
No, it's fascinating, actually.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you bring...
Sorry, go ahead.
It's funny you bring up the book. I mean, yeah, like just like reading into it and realizing that it's based on a book by Jonathan Ames. And like as soon as I heard that name, I'm like, wait a minute. The guy who created the TV show Bored to Death, like, which was a comedy. I'm like, this is that guy wrote this book, because this book is like nothing compared to the TV show.
And the movie is very pulpy, very like B-movie kind of esque as well.
Yeah, it adds to that, because this isn't it was shot in New York. It's set in New York, but it was also shot in New York. So it does have that New York authenticity, which, you know, again, revisits comparisons to Taxi Driver as well.
Well, yeah, actually, the other comparison too is the fact that he's actually trying to save a daughter of a guy who's running for governor, and in Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle becomes obsessed with this guy who's running for the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And So shooting it in New York too is interesting. Going back to what we were saying about, you know, how it was shot, the voyeuristic way it was shot in the street, and it's interesting because there's a scene where somebody stops him to take a picture. A group of girls who I guess maybe are out sightseeing or something. They're like, "Can you take our picture?" And he does, and he almost loses it right there. Mm. Talking about PTSD, You know, you see how, like, just the act of taking a picture of people having a good time is, like, painful.
Yeah.
He feels pain watching people have fun, and you see him actually have to, like, sit down and take
another
a break.
Slow motion sequence in the movie.
That is another slow motion sequence as he's sort of, like, trying to process, like, them laughing and having fun, and as he's trying to take a picture, it's like, that's messed up. Yeah.
Kind of unrelated, but kind of related. I was reading an interview with Lynn Ramsey about this film, and I sent you this little tidbit, which I thought was fascinating. Okay, there's a part where his mother is watching Psycho, and apparently it costs like $13,000 to use the e sound from Psycho, and it's like $30,000 if you use it twice. So they did like one take of Joaquin Phoenix doing the noise, and she was like, "All right, let's keep that."
Psycho is an interesting comparison because you do sort of get that feeling that they kind of have a psycho relationship. That it's you know, maybe mom and son are a little too close, have been, sort of been in the same close quarters for too long.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of subverted later on when his mother is killed, and it's like he wears the grief on his face, like he's failed her, and it's. It's an incredibly powerful scene. I mean, this whole film is just like, we could like break it down scene after scene of just, you know, of what it's saying and how well it's constructed. I do want to put out a shout out for the sound design of the film too, because I think like half of everything you find deeply unsettling about this movie comes from what you're hearing.
Yeah.
And there are parts of the film where I don't know if it's if it's the Johnny Greenwood score.
The great Johnny Greenwood. Yeah.
Or if it's like the sound design, like if it's like a purposeful kind of like sonic assault to like make you unsettled, or if it's an intentional part of the soundtrack that he did, and there are times they flow into each other.
It's almost got a John Carpenter kind of like music feel to it, like a thriller-esque.
Well, and it's got synth stuff in it too, which makes,
Well, and like being familiar with like almost every single movie that John Greenwood's done a score from, like it has a very similar sound to There Will Be Blood, has a very, and even we need to talk about Kevin as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another movie based on a book as well that she adapted.
Yeah. It's amazing. I don't think I've watched We Need to Talk About Kevin since I saw it the first time and only time.
Yeah, you need to be in a mood for a Lynn Ramsey film.
But, you know, I think I could watch this again.
Yes, absolutely.
Which, because I it's tight. It's 90 minutes, so it's a very tight film. So it does kind of have that thriller aspect to it as well. But I think it's also worth rewatching because... you know, there's a lot of stuff in it that kind of quickly passes you by, and it's kind of never addressed again. It might be one of those films that, you know, is worth going back for in order to do the deeper dive. You've sort of lived through it once, but there's so much going on in terms of, you know, where the editing is. Like, a lot of those flashbacks are like, they're over.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to piece together what this guy's psyche is, what his backstory is. And I think that other viewings, it might...
Reveal
a bit
more about
because
it.
You know, I think it's also a bit more hopeful than We Need to Talk About Kevin. There's some sign at the end that maybe he has, if not reached a turning point, then it's reached a tipping point. Whereas I think in We Need to Talk About Kevin, it's just like this is what it is, and that's tough to walk away from.
Well, the interesting point, I guess, about the violence and We Need to Talk About Kevin and You Were Never Really Here is, like, in We Need to Talk About Kevin, you don't see any of the violence sequences at all.
No.
And from what I understood, actually, that was a budgetary issue. Like, they didn't have the money to show any of that gory violence. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they actually did. Mm-hmm. But even then, they kind of left it, like, almost off screen, but not quite. Or they quickly cut away.
What's interesting is, and we need to talk about Kevin, the only violence you see is actually against the Tilda Swinton character, the mother.
Right.
Because the most powerful scene in that film for me is the scene where she gets some really good news about a new job, and she's walking down the street, and she feels happy for the first time, and then she coincidentally crosses paths with one of the mothers of her son's victims, and she says, "Oh, so we're smiling today," and slaps her. And that is like, you know, because you've been living with this woman for an hour, and you've seen her like struggle with what did I do, what did I not do, in terms of how my son was raised to be a school murderer. And then she gets a little bit of like one piece of good news, and it's immediately lobotomized.
And her previous films didn't really have the flashbacks that this movie had. You know what I mean? They're all kind of straightforward narratives. I heard that she's not actually a big fan of flashbacks.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure I would call these flashbacks. They're almost flashes, like just flashes of information.
Flashback implies you're going back into the story from before the film began to add insight, and that's not it at all. You're just you're quickly given insight into maybe what's going on in his head, in so much as, you know, maybe it could be conveyed in a look or him talking to himself in some sort of inner monologue or something. You get these like quick images instead, which is even more unsettling, because I think in a different filmmaker's hands there would have been a scene where he would have had to stop and say to someone, "Okay, here's why I messed up." That's not this movie, because I think A, it would have probably brought things to a screeching halt, and B, I think the film gives us enough to draw a pretty good picture of what Joe's inner life is and what he's thinking, and it's a really good collaboration between what the actor is doing and what the director is doing, and it really fills in the blanks. And you know, the way I fill in the blanks might be different from how you fill in the blanks, in terms of how we understand this character. But I think we all, in the end, get to the same place, which is that, you know, Joe is a complicated guy trying to find some sort of solace in trying to save people that in a way that he couldn't save himself or his mother. And whether or not that's working, because it certainly doesn't seem to be working, at least maybe until the end, maybe it is working.
Yeah, no, it's just funny you bring that up about the being a collaboration between director and actors, because every single interview that I've ever paid attention to between both actors and directors, usually if there's a failure in a movie and it becomes kind of lopsided, either the actor or the director will speak out against the other and saying, like, "Oh, I didn't agree with what his view was," or clearly this actor didn't get the part that I wanted them to play.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even if it does go right, not to bring this back to blockbusters, but there was, when Last Jedi came out, Mark Hamill said that Rian Johnson's vision for Luke Skywalker wasn't his vision for Luke Skywalker.
Oh, yeah, I do recall him saying that.
But sometimes you do have to put yourself in the hands of the director, and I think Joaquin Phoenix did that quite well. He may hate interviews, but I wouldn't mind hearing a bit what his thoughts were on Joe.
And I'm very curious to see if Lynn Ramsey could do like a bigger budget kind of thing, like what her take on kind of like a, I hate to say blockbuster again, but like, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
If she found the right script and the right kind of project, I think she could definitely do something very, very interesting.
It would be interesting to see what she could do with something like, you know, I don't know why this just popped in my head, but, you know, Girl on the Train, which is also very much about, you know, a main character who's got issues, and whether or not what they think is going on is what is really going on in that perception. I would be interested in that too, because Lynn Ramsey's remarkably talented and a great visual storyteller.
Probably one of the best independent filmmakers,
I think,
working today.
Yeah, and in actual fact, I just watched Girl on the Train very recently, and I was actually very impressed with the visual style of that movie. Mm-hmm. But it was a bit uneven. Like, but if someone like Lynn Ramsey was to direct it, I think it would have been probably much, much more superior.
And Emily Blunt was really great in that. Not to get too deep into Girl on the Train, but if she had a director with that could really sort of test her capabilities, who knows? Well, we gotta play ourselves out now, but if you like this episode of End Credits, and we hope you liked it, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, find all our episodes there. Find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on Facebook and End Credits Radio on Twitter. Jesse, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Facebook, and I do have and I'm on Twitter as well.
Okay. Vince?
I'm on Facebook as well, and you can find me on Twitter at VMassin5.
He finally got it. He finally
Took a year of episodes to get it. You can see how many retweets Steven Soderbergh didn't give me, so if you want to. Yeah. Steven, one day, my friend, one day.
Vince will find you. You can find me tomorrow at 5 p.m. on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits. We will see you then.